By now you should be in John chapter 12, have that marked, and then find your place in 1 Samuel chapter 20. And I think one of the hardest things to deal with in the Christian life is when you are following God with all of your heart, taking steps of faith, you're trying to do the right things and you're wanting to do them for the right reasons, and things are not turning out the way that you hoped. Problems are escalating, trials are mounting, and you find yourself asking the questions, why, God? And did I do something wrong? Well, that's where David finds himself in 1 Samuel chapter 18 through 20. And at this particular time in the life of David, he's in a trial that is going to test the endurance of his faith to the limits. And every outward circumstance that he finds himself in seems to contradict God's plan for David's life. Remember, we saw a couple weeks ago how Samuel came to Bethlehem, there to the house of Jesse, to anoint one of his sons to be the next king in Israel. And the one that was chosen was David. But now, as David finds himself in this place, the current circumstances that he finds himself in made the promises of God feel like lies. And that can happen to us as well. You know, we have this tendency to think that A plus B is always going to equal C. But when that's not happening in our lives, we can be prone to think, what am I doing wrong? Now, it's in those instances, it's in those type of circumstances that we must decide what we are going to be ruled by. Are we going to be ruled by our circumstances that can be all over the place? Are we going to be ruled by our emotions that can be changing every single day? Or are we going to be ruled by what we know to be true about God? Well, let's see how this plays out in the life of David today. Here's our roadmap for our study. We're going to divide the study into two parts. We're going to begin looking at David's difficult season. And in David's difficult season, we're going to see three lessons. We're going to see that difficult seasons call for a desperate need of truth. We're also going to see that difficult seasons call for dependable friends. And we're going to see that difficult seasons call for deep faith. And then in part two, we're going to look at how in these difficult seasons that we find ourselves in, that we have a stone of Ezel to hide in. And that stone of Ezel is a place of trust, it's a place of transition, and it's a place of testimony. And I think that part will make sense when we get there. But let's begin with David's difficult season. We've seen that David has been living his life to please God. He takes this huge step of faith in being the one to volunteer and go out and fight against the giant Goliath, and God gave him victory. David's star is rising, and he's thrust into a position of leading troops into battle. And once again, he is victorious in that. And the people of Israel are starting to sing his praises. In fact, the number one song on the charts is this song that Saul has slain his thousands, and David has slain his tens of thousands. But it's at that particular time that the trouble begins to start, because King Saul becomes insanely jealous of David. And he starts, as we saw last week, he's chucking spears at David. He's trying to kill him. But each time David is able to elude this murder attempt. And so Saul ends up sending David back out into battle, no doubt hoping that David is going to die. He's going to be killed by the Philistines. But God keeps blessing David. And that's where I want to pick it up today in chapter 18, verse 12. We'll go back a little bit here. Notice what it says. Now, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Now, that's interesting that Saul recognizes, okay, God's hand is on this young man, but it's obvious that his hand is no longer on me. Verse 13, therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved wisely in all of his ways, and the Lord was with him. And therefore, when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. Pause there and give me your attention. Now, it's obvious to Saul that God's hand is on David. It's obvious, it seems like, to everyone that God's hand is on David. It should be obvious to Saul that David is to be his successor, but instead of seeking to help David move into that role, Saul sees David, he's threatened by his presence. So he orchestrates a series of events in hopes of bringing David down. And the first thing he does is he wants to put a woman in David's life to bring him down. And remember that when David defeated Goliath, remember Saul had told everyone in the army that the man who defeats this giant, there's three things that I'm going to give to him. I'll give him great riches. His family will no longer have to pay taxes. And I'll give my daughter as a bride. Now, Saul's oldest daughter was Miriam, and she should have been the prize for killing Goliath. But when she became of age, the age to be married, Saul ends up giving her to someone else. But now in this moment, when Saul is wanting to bring down David, he says to himself, he decides, I'm going to give my daughter Michal to be his wife. And look at verse 20. It says, now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. And they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. So Saul said, I will give her to him that she may be a snare to him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Now, that's not a very nice thing to say about your daughter, right? I know what I'll do. I know how I'll bring him down. I'll give him my daughter, Michal, to be his wife, and she will be a snare to him. You know, I'm going to get this problem child out of my house. Well, actually, this could be taken in two ways. Number one, it could be in reference to the dowry. You see, it was always customary that the groom, the family of the groom, would give a dowry to the father of the bride for the wife that was being given. And the dowry that, as you read on, that Saul requested is 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Now, I know that's really, really gross. Don't think about that too much, okay? Kind of a weird offer. But the idea here is that David's going to go out and he's going to kill 100 Philistines. And Saul, no doubt, is hoping that David is going to get killed in the process. Now, it also could mean that Saul knew something about his daughter's character and that she was maybe difficult. And so he's saying, you know, I'm going to give my daughter to David that she might trip him up. And it could be both of those things. And we'll definitely see some things later on in the story with David where we see some poor things about Michal's character later on in our story of the life of David. Well, David delivers on the foreskins and he gets to marry Michal. And I want you to skip down to verse 28. And it says this, thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. Now, this should be great, right? I got this new son-in-law and my daughter loves him. You think that he would be so excited, but he's not. Verse 29. And Saul was still more afraid of David. And so Saul became David's enemy continually. I mean, that had to make for some awkward family gatherings, right? You know, I mean, he just hates this, you know, young man. So David is doing everything right here. David is, God's hand is on him. His favor is growing in the kingdom. So much so that in chapter 19, as Saul's hatred of David is just growing, his jealousy is growing. In chapter 19, Saul actually puts a contract out on David's life. Now, Jonathan, his son, David's friend, steps in initially. And he gets his, you know, he reasons with his dad and he gets his dad to see the error of his way. And Saul backs off for a little bit, but it doesn't last very long. And so Saul eventually ends up commissioning this contract, these guys to go out and kill David. And at this point, after this assassination attempt that you can read about in chapter 19, David is at his wit's end and he's wondering, what have I done? And why is this happening? And that's where I want to pick up the story in chapter 20. It says, Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? Notice David's questions. What did I do? How did I sin? How have I gone wrong? How have I misread this? And you know what's interesting is that you, when we walk with the Lord, we can get confused when life doesn't turn out the way that we think that it should. We can get confused when people are coming against us or saying things about us. And we get confused and we think, well, what did I do wrong? You know, you might not have done anything wrong. You might have done everything right. In fact, in this case, the fault wasn't on David. The fault was on King Saul. And sometimes just following the Lord and just loving God and just trusting in Jesus, that's enough for unbelievers to hate you. That's enough for the ungodly people to be upset with you. That's enough for a carnal Christians to not like you. So David he's uptight here. He's despairing. As the pressure is building, David isn't handling this very well. Fear is taking root in his heart. And Alan Redpath, if you want to read an amazing book or commentary on the life of David, Alan Redpath's The Making of a Man of God is second to none. It is phenomenal. Alan Redpath says this, that fear is the greatest enemy of our faith. Fear causes despair. Fear can blow things out of proportion. Fear doesn't need truth. Fear only needs imagination. And if fear is unchecked, it creates a world of what ifs that are never going to happen. What if this happens? What if that happens? And by these what ifs, we end up being held hostage. We are paralyzed by our fear. So David is in this difficult season that is causing him to question everything. And this brings us to our first point. In difficult seasons, call for a desperate need of truth, because truth trumps fear every time. Or at least it should. Pastor Chuck used to say, when you do not know what is going on, you need to fall back on what you do know. Now, Jonathan comes and he tries to bring truth into the situation. Look at verse 2. And Jonathan said to him, by no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing either great or small without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so. So Jonathan comes and he's like, oh, come on, bro. You're seeing this the wrong way. There's no way. I mean, my dad would tell me if he was going to do something like that. Jonathan seems completely unaware that his dad has put out this second contract out on David's life. And so David's going to challenge his reasoning. Look at verse 3. Then David took an oath again and said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes and that he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. He's like, look, your dad knows that you and I, that we're really, really good friends, and he doesn't want to hurt you. He doesn't want to, you know, discourage you. But then David says, but truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but one step between me and death. Guys, in difficult seasons, we have to step back to discern what is real from what is only imagined. We have to step back and look at the situation properly to discern what is truth. And David says to Jonathan, hey, bro, I know, I hear what you're saying. I know your heart, but here's the deal. Here's the truth. There is only one step between me and death. And at this point, Jonathan sees David's despair and he pivots. He faces reality. And so Jonathan says in verse 4, whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you. Now notice at this point, Jonathan quits trying to convince David that this is all in his mind. But instead he says, whatever you need, I've got you. Whatever you need, I'm here. And this brings us to our second point. In difficult seasons, we need dependable friends. You see, difficult seasons are seasons that are not meant for us to walk alone. This is the beauty of the body of Christ. This is the beauty of the family of God. We need friends that will stand with us and walk with us in the midst of those difficult times. Remember that definition of friendship we looked at last week, where we talked about that a friend is one who runs in when the whole world is running out? That's what we need in difficult seasons. We need friends that are going to run in. It's in difficult seasons that you come to find who your friends really are. And Jonathan is running in when everybody else is going to be running away. So in seeking truth, David devises a plan that is going to reveal King Saul's heart and true intentions. Look at verse 5. And David said to Jonathan, indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I shall not fail to sit with the king to eat. Now, a new moon was what they called the beginning of every Jewish month. And according to the book of Leviticus, when you'd have a new moon, it was considered a civil holiday and a spiritual holiday. And in some months, they would have 2 to 3 days set aside to feast and celebrate the new moon or the new month. And if you worked for the king, you were expected to be at his table for those feasts. It was a sign of your support and your loyalty to the king. And so David knew that. He says, I should not fail to sit at the king's table. It's like he's saying, look, I know I'm expected to be there. But then David says this in the latter part of verse 5, but let me go that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. And if your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all of the family. And if he says thus, it is well, then your servant will be safe. If Saul's like, okay, yeah, no big deal. But if he is very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? David says, look, we've made this covenant. And if your dad gets mad, you know that there's evil that's committed here. And you know what? Why not? If that's the case, if I've done something wrong, why don't you just kill me yourself? But Jonathan said, far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you? It's like, bro, you can trust me. And then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me, or what if your father answers you roughly? And Jonathan said to David, come, let us go into the field. So both of them went out into the field. And then Jonathan said to David, the Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father, in other words, when I have felt out my father, when I've assessed the situation sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send and tell you, may the Lord do so much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and send you away that you may go in safety. And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. In other words, Jonathan is saying there, when God puts you in position to be the king, may he be with you as he was with my father, at least in the beginning. And then he says, verse 14, and you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my father's house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemy. And so what they're doing here is really renewing the covenant that we talked about they made in chapter 18. We talked about this last week. This covenant, because it was common when a new royal, when a new person would come upon the throne of a kingdom, in that culture, that new king would eliminate. He would have killed anybody from the old royal house, anybody that could be a threat to him. And so Jonathan is saying, hey, I know one day you are going to be the king of Israel. And I'm just asking, this is the covenant I want to renew with you. I want to make with you that we made when I first met you, that when you become king, you won't destroy my family. That you won't take out those who are my descendants. So they make this covenant with one another. In verse 17, now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. That's such a powerful line. In fact, in the Christian Standard Bible, it puts it this way. Jonathan once again swore to David in his love for him because he loved him as he loved himself. Remember what Jesus said about the commandments of God? Jesus said all the commandments of God can be summed up in these two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jonathan, in this picture, in this story, is such a beautiful picture of that idea of loving your neighbor as yourself, as he is putting the needs of his friend above his own. So Jonathan agreed to care for David in the face of Saul's threat, and David agreed to care for Jonathan and his family in the future. We pick it up in verse 18. Then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed and remain by the stone of Azel. Now, I want you to notice that line there in the story where it says, and when you have stayed 3 days, then go down to the hiding place, the place that I'm showing you right now. And most scholars believe that David actually did go down to his father's house, that he went down to the feast there, that they weren't lying, that they weren't making up a story. But then after he had stayed 3 days, then he would return to the appointed spot, to the stone of Azel, to wait for this word from Jonathan. So that was the plan. Jonathan continues there in verse 20. And then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And there I will send a lad saying, go find the arrows. And if I expressly say to the lad, look, the arrows are on this side of you, get them and come. And then as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm. So if I say I shoot the arrows, and I say, hey, they're to the side of you. That's going to be a sign to you. It's going to be the message that everything's safe, that it's okay. But if I say thus to the young man, look, the arrows are beyond you, then that means go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed, the Lord be between you and me forever. We're going to be friends forever. So that was the plan. And this brings us to our third point, that difficult seasons call for deep faith. And David here he's being called to wait upon the Lord. He's being called to exercise deep faith in the Lord and in his friend. And you know, I think the hardest seasons in life are the ones where you and I, we can't do anything but wait and trust. We can't do anything but say, Lord, I don't know how this is going to play out. I don't know, you know, how this situation is going to end, but I am trusting you. I'm believing that you have my best interest at heart. That can be so hard for us. Especially those of you who, like myself, are kind of type A personality, you know, where you just want to make things happen. You just want to, you know, take it, you know, grab the hands and grab the reins. It can be so hard to wait like that, but it can also be so good for us. Remember what Isaiah wrote, the promise that he gave in Proverbs 40:31, but those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. And they shall mount up with wings like eagles, and they shall run and not be weary, and they shall walk and not faint. The waiting seasons are those seasons where God is using them to build up our spiritual muscles. Those waiting seasons are God is using them to develop deep faith within us. And so that was the plan. Now, for the sake of time, I want to summarize what happens next. So they have the feast of the new moon, and Saul is sitting at his table, and he notices that first day that David isn't there. But he thinks to himself, well, David, he might be sick. Maybe he's ceremonially unclean. Maybe he has something going on. And so he just kind of, you know, doesn't think about it. But then the next day, when David's seat is empty, the king Saul asked his son Jonathan, hey, where's David? And Jonathan tells his dad that David asked permission to go down to his family's house there in Bethlehem and to celebrate with them. And David says, I gave him permission to do that. And then Saul flies off the rails. And basically he says to Jonathan, you're the son of a whore and you're an idiot because you don't, and it's what he says basically. You're the son of a whore and you're an idiot because Jonathan doesn't understand. He doesn't realize, you know, in Saul's mind that David's going to take his throne from him. And on top of that, Saul point blank says in front of everyone, bring David to me that he may die. And when Jonathan questions his father's reasoning, he says, what has he done that he deserves death? Saul picks up a spear and throws it at his own son. To kill him. I mean, this is how crazy, how demented Saul has become. And so we'll pick it up in verse 34. So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. So the next day, Jonathan is going to send word to David where he's to meet him. Where he's going to be waiting at the stone of Ezel. And the stone of Ezel means the stone that shows the way, or the stone of destiny. And David was to wait by this stone. And I want you to capture this. The direction for the next 13 years, David doesn't know it's going to be 13 years. But the direction of the next 13 years of his life is going to be revealed at this stone. And this brings us to the second part of our study. In difficult seasons, we also have a stone of Ezel to hide in. You see, for every Christian, in every circumstance of life, we also have a stone of Ezel, a stone that shows the way. A stone of destiny. Daniel speaks of this stone in Daniel chapter 2, verse 34, and he calls it a stone cut without hands. Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, calls it a living stone. Isaiah the prophet in Isaiah chapter 28 calls it a foundation stone, a precious stone, a sure foundation. And none of them are talking about a rock. They're talking about a person because Jesus is that stone. Jesus is our stone of Ezel. Jesus is the one that we are called to rest in. Jesus is the one that we are called to seek refuge in. He's the one and the only one who shows the way for our lives, who knows the destiny of our lives. And so this is what we learn about Jesus, our stone of Ezel, that Jesus, our stone of Ezel, is a place of trust, but he's also a place of transition, and he's a place of testimony. Let's consider how he's a place of trust. Again, Redpath put it this way. Jesus is our stone of destiny rooted in a rugged hillside outside of the city of Jerusalem. There we understand that he bore our burden, that he is the great burden bearer. The pressure of the burdens we face, no matter what they may be, are rolled away when we bring them and leave them at his feet. Redpath is telling us that the cross and the resurrection of Jesus are his credentials to be our stone of Ezel. In fact, Paul the Apostle in Romans chapter 8 would put it this way. He says, you want to know how you can know that God cares for you? You want to know how you can know that God will take care of you? Well, here's how. He's already given you his very best. He's already given you his only son, his beloved son. Don't you know that he will freely give you all things? And so I ask today, are you in a predicament? Do you have a tough decision that you find yourself in, or a tough place where things are just kind of out of your hands? There's nothing you can do but wait and trust God. I want to encourage you to do what David did and wait at your stone of destiny. That's a hard place to be in, but it's also a good place to be in, where your entire fate rests in the hands of Jesus. Jesus, who stretches out his hands that are nail scarred and says, hey, I've got you. I love you. Remember, here's how you know. And it's in those times, and I think this is a word from the Lord for somebody here today, you have to resist the temptation to run. You have to resist the temptation to go, I'm out of here. You have to resist the temptation to want to take matters into your own hands and say to Jesus, I trust you. I'll wait on you. I believe in you. So Jesus, our stone of Ezel, is a place of trust. But he's also a place of transition. Let's see how this works out in David's life. Look at verse 35. And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the same time appointed with David. And a little lad was with him. And then he said to the lad, now run and find the arrows which I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. And so Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. And then Jonathan gave his weapons to the lad and said, go and carry them into the city. Now I want you to picture here. I want you to picture David hiding there by the stone of Ezel. And from a distance, he hears his friend Jonathan coming. He hears him coming, you know, with this lad. And Jonathan is, you know, making like he's going to do some target practice. And he takes his arrow and he shoots it. And David is anxiously awaiting and watching the flight of this arrow as it arches over him and lands beyond him. Imagine the feelings at that moment, that he knew in that moment the Lord was sending him away. Such a small thing. The flight of a single arrow told David that his whole life was about to change forever. This flight of a single arrow was telling him he would no longer be welcomed at the palace, that he would no longer be welcome among the army of Israel, that he would no longer be able to go home and see his wife or go to Bethlehem and see his family. David realizes in that moment that he's going to live as a fugitive, that he would live on the run for the next 13 years from this angry, maniacal king who wanted to destroy him. And as the arrows were fired and hit their mark, if David didn't know it in that moment, he would realize eventually these arrows were not just from the hand of Jonathan, but they were from the hand of God. Jonathan was the instrument, but the arrows were from the hand of God, and they were right on target. And what would ensue is David would spend the next 13 years of his life living on the run, living as a fugitive. His reputation among the people would be completely smeared. But David knew that God knew the truth about him. David knew that God knew his heart. And in this moment, there's nothing he can do but trust God. And the next 13 years of David's life, him living on the run, listen, would be the means that God would use to form David into a man of God. The next 13 years would be the means in David's life that God would use to further make him into a man after God's own heart. The next 13 years would be the means that God would use to train up David to make him the greatest king that Israel would ever have until Jesus showed up. And so the arrows fall. And Jonathan's servant scoops them up, and Jonathan tells him to take them back into the city. And we read in verse 41, and as soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south and fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times. And they kissed one another, and they wept together, but David the more so. Now, I want you to picture this, and don't get thrown off by they kiss one another. It was a customary thing. It was a Jewish thing. It's like you go to Israel today, and they do that today. They kiss each other, one side of the face and the other side of the face. And in Israel, they do it three times. And so they're greeting one another. But these two incredible warriors are weeping convulsively. Picture this. Their hearts are broken. They're holding one another, and they're just sobbing in this moment. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord be between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" And so he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. Now, in this transition time in David's life, this is what God's doing. God is removing all of the crutches. All of the crutches. The crutch of his friend Jonathan. The crutch of his family. The crutch of stability and having a place to live. The crutch of the prestige that David had among the people. And guys, transition times are often times where our crutches are being taken away. Because crutches have a way of keeping our focus on the horizontal. We're focused on people and things around us instead of the God who is above us. Crutches bring temporary relief, and they make us feel safe to the danger around us, but crutches can paralyze the walk of faith. Because we're leaning on others instead of leaning on God. You know, if you've ever been on crutches, I've had two, you know, hip replacements and a knee operation. And you know, when you're on crutches, it's like you're putting your stability in those crutches. But there always comes a moment where a moment of faith where it's like, okay, I got to test this now. I got to test this leg. I got to see if it's going to hold me. And in this moment, in these moments when God is stripping away the crutches, Jesus is saying, "Are you going to trust me?" It's a moment of faith. Are you going to lean on me alone? And God uses different instruments as arrows in our lives at times to lead us into times of transition. Sometimes it can be the word of a good friend. A word spoken. It's a word from the Lord. And you know it's from the Lord. And it means that there's a change that is coming. It could be a doctor's diagnosis. It could be a word from an employer. Hey, sorry, we're going to have to let you go. Those are the arrows. But behind the arrow, we have to understand this, is God's loving purpose for your life. Now, for David to become the man of God that God wanted him to be, he had to embrace this time of transition. We're going to see next week where he doesn't do that right away. He actually runs to the enemy. But David had to accept that this was the road that God had chosen from him. And the chapter ends with these words concerning David. So he arose and departed. And David would not return to what we could call normal life until Saul was dead and David was king. This was a bleak road. And David is stepping into a bleak road, but it was God's road for him. But God will teach David during this time to depend on him alone. Not Saul, not himself, not Jonathan, not anyone else. This was David's transition time. Put before him, put out, laid out in that moment, the shot of an arrow at the stone of Ezel. Now, I can't help but think about a scene and a time in the life of Jesus that I think correlates with this so well. So real quick, turn over to John chapter 12, and we're going to wrap this up. John chapter 12, it's the final week of Jesus. It's days before his betrayal. And notice verse 20. It says, now there were certain Greeks among those who came to worship at the feast. And then they came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and asked him, saying, sir, we wish to see Jesus. Now pause there for just a moment. And right there, I want you to notice, these guys come to Jerusalem, to these Greek guys, to worship at the feast. But in the midst of their coming to worship, they want to see Jesus. And I just want to share, that's the true essence of worship. That we come because we want to see Jesus. We want to see Jesus, we want to touch Jesus, and we want to be touched by Jesus. That's the true essence of worship. So then it says in verse 22, Philip came and told Andrew, and in turn Andrew and Philip told Jesus, but Jesus answered them saying, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. So Andrew and Philip come and say, hey, there's these Greek guys we met. You know, they come to worship and they want to meet you. They want to see you. And it's like Jesus doesn't even hear them. Jesus says this kind of weird thing. The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. This is the first time he's ever said that. Any other time when the people would want to come and they want to make Jesus king, you know, he would say, the hour is not, it's not the hour, it's not the time for the Son of Man to be glorified. Let's get out of here. But here in this moment, he says, now is the time. And he proceeds to show how he's going to be glorified, that it would be in his death. Notice, he says, most assuredly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain. He who loves his life will lose it. And he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. And if anyone serves me, him my Father will honor. What Jesus does here is he gives this analogy from nature. He says, look, in order for this seed to bear fruit, it has to die. It has to be buried. It has to be put into the ground. And this was a reference to his own life. What he was going to do. That he was coming to die. That he was coming to be buried. So that his life would bring forth even more fruit. The fruit of salvation to anyone and everyone who would believe. And guys, this is the kind of life that Jesus invites us into. To die to self. To die to self-comfort, to be willing to become unseen, to die to self-promotion so that others can be advanced. So here's the choice that all of us have all the time. The choice is we can remain alone. We can seek to protect ourselves, live for ourselves, and the result of that is no fruit and no spiritual impact. Or we can seek to die to ourselves and to live for Jesus and seek to be a blessing for others. And the result of that, Jesus said, is much fruit and honor from God. So this is the choice. This is what he calls all of us to follow in his example. But I want you to notice what he says next. I think this is so incredibly powerful. Then Jesus says, verse 27, my soul is troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. What is happening here? Jesus in this moment is wrestling with his humanity. He's wrestling within his humanity and his flesh with what he knows is coming, the cross. And the fact that all of the sin of the world is going to be placed upon him. And in that moment, he's going to experience for the very first time separation from his Father. That the weight of all the sin, past, present, future, is being thrust upon him. And he knows that. And his soul, he's wrestling like, Lord, my soul is troubled. Save me from this hour. But I want you to notice how he deals with the tension. In the second part of verse 27, he says this, but for this purpose, I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Here's the key. Here's what he's illustrating for us. We all need to realize our purpose. And listen, our purpose, each one of us, we exist to glorify God. Jesus knew, I'm here to bring glory to my Father. And that means death. That means a cross. That means shame. That means the sin of the world being put upon me. But we're told in the book of Hebrews that he joyfully endured that. That has to be our perspective. Where we choose and all these difficult circumstances in our life, we choose God's glory over our comfort. We choose God's purpose over our plan. And there will be times and seasons where his glory in your life is going to mean death to something. Death to your plans. Death to your hopes. Death to your dreams. Death to your comfort so that he can be glorified. The question is, will we be ready, willing to do that? That's the question. So Jesus, our stone of Ezel, is not just a place of trust, not just a place of transition, but also a place of testimony. The testimony of God's faithfulness, the testimony of God's refining process, the testimony of, hey, this is God's perfect plan. David is going to look back on this time and realize how God used those 13 years to mold him, to refine him. This transition season, the season of trust, is going to become a part of his testimony. And we're going to see in the coming weeks that he didn't do everything right. I mean, in this season, he runs to the enemy twice. We're going to see that there's part of this season where he actually is agreeing to join the Philistines in fighting against the people of Israel, the people he was called to lead. Think about that. It's crazy. I mean, he backslides hard during part of this season. And during that time when he's backsliding, he writes no psalms, no record of any psalm that David writes during that backsliding season. And some of you are wondering, what are we going to do on Wednesday nights when you know, if he didn't write any psalms, you know, you'll have to come and find out, you know, what we're going to do. But his testimony, David's going to learn during this time to seek God like he never has before. And his testimony is recorded for us to learn from, that we can do the same in our times of transition. Now, before we go today, I want us to consider one last thing real quickly. Back there in verse 4, David makes a statement that I think is a powerful statement. He says there, I'm going to have him put it on the wall, there is but one step between me and death. That's a powerful statement, but it's also a true statement. See, David was learning that his life was hanging by a thread. We don't typically think of life that way, do we? Especially when we're young. I mean, when we're young, we think we're invincible. But sometimes, you know, we carry that same attitude into, you know, old age, and we think we're invincible, and we try things that we have no business trying, and we end up, you know, hurt, or we end up in the hospital, right? It's like, oh, my back, you know, kind of thing. But, you know, the truth is there's an appointed day of death for each one of us. But the thing is, God doesn't tell you this is your appointed day. It's going to be May 25th, 2025. I'm not prophesying here for anybody, okay? But you never know. He doesn't tell us. But we'll find out, because one day we're going to wake up and we're going to be standing before God and we're going to like, oh, I guess this is my day. Hi, God. And the question, though, is going to be is, are you ready for that? Are you ready to stand before God? Yes, it's true. There is one step between you and death, but there's also, this is equally true, there's one step between you and life. There's one step between you and eternal life. And if you have not given your life to Jesus, if you haven't embraced what Jesus did for you, how he was died and he buried, he was the seed that was buried so that you could experience a relationship with God, I want to encourage you today, open up your heart to him. Take that step into eternal life. If you're here today and you're kind of, you've been living on the fence and you're thinking, oh, I've got time. You may not. The Bible says tomorrow is promised to no man. And if you are going to gamble with your eternity, if you are going to gamble with the certainty that's going to come of your death and spiritual matters, which are the most important matters, if you're willing, you know, to gamble with that, you are the greatest definition of a fool, a foolish person. So don't be a fool today. Trust Jesus. Amen.